Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for Monday, June 29th, 2020. This is Air Force veteran David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thank you for joining us this evening. We have a special guest today, as well as more news of interest to veterans and their families. But let's first go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard. How are things going?
Hey, David. Hey, everything's going well. How's everybody out there? And hope everybody's surviving and hanging in there with this coronavirus that's weighing a heavy load here, especially here in Florida. But we have a special guest tonight, Mr. Mike Partain. Mike's been on our show many times, and he's always a man of a lot of information. Tonight he's going to talk again about the toxic water contamination at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, which, as everybody knows, was between 1953 and 1987. But I want to remind everybody out there that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. I believe tonight we've got a number of listeners from the Camp Lejeune Water Contamination Facebook site. We've been advertising Mike's appearance on that Facebook site for the past week. So if any of you are out there and you want to call in and talk to Mike, again, that number is 1-888-627-6008. Mike Partain is a co-founder and public spokesman for the organization called The Few, the Proud, the Forgotten. From 1953 until 1987, the base water supply for Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, was highly contaminated with industrial chemicals. And for the past decade, he has served as a community representative to the estimated 1 million sailors, Marines, and their families potentially affected by the Camp Lejeune contamination. He has testified before Congress. He was invited as a special guest to the White House in 2012 for the signing of the Janie Ensminger Act into law. Much of his group's fight for justice was chronicled in the award-winning documentary Semper Fi, Always Faithful. So without further ado, let's welcome Mike Partain to the Veterans News Hour. How are you tonight, Mike?
Doing well. How about yourself?
About the same. About the same. So for the benefit of our first-time listeners, tell us briefly, you know, what got you involved in everything you've been doing with the Camp Lejeune and water contamination issue. And I know it's a personal issue, too. So just briefly set the stage for our first-time listeners.
Okay. Well, my involvement began roughly 13 years ago in April 2007 after I was diagnosed out of the blue with male breast cancer. It's a disease that typically affects older men, 70 years or older, who typically have either the BRCA1 or 2 marker or are of Eastern European Jewish descent. I had none of those markers or conditions. Breast cancer is something that doesn't run in my family, male or female. And, we scratched my head. A few months after I was diagnosed, my father happened to catch a news story on CNN about the place where I was born. My father was a Naval Academy graduate and Marine officer. My grandfather was a Mustang. He went in 39 as an enlisted and retired from the Marine Corps in 1961 as a major. And I was born in a place called Camp Lejeune, and up until that time, it really didn't mean much to me other than having a long name on my birth certificate. Contacted Jerry Ensminger shortly afterwards and talked to him and heard his story about his little girl, Janie, who was conceived at Camp Lejeune and then came back later when she was a little bit older. And she was diagnosed with leukemia and passed away at the age of 9 in 1985. Hearing Jerry's story and then getting into the documents and reading through what the Marine Corps had said transferred at the base versus what we were seeing in the documents, pitched my efforts to help Jerry understand what really happened to us, understand the contamination, and join the fight for justice at Camp Lejeune. Which, you know, we've, at first it was a lot of doors slammed in our face. Then in 2009, 2010, and then by 2012, we started, you know, making leeway in Congress, and that culminated in 2012 with the first major victory that we had with Camp Lejeune, which was the signing of the Jenny Ensminger Act in the law that provided health care for the Marines and their families, as well as the other service members from the different branches who were stationed at Camp Lejeune for more than 30 days. Lately, in 2017, we saw the largest presumptive service connection established for Camp Lejeune by the VA for eight conditions that are associated with the toxic drinking water, which the water was contaminated to various degrees from 1953 to 1987, and they estimate about a million Marines and their families and workers aboard the base were all exposed to this contaminated water during this time period. A few weeks ago, we had our CAP meeting at the end of May. CAP stands for the Community Assistance Panel, where Jerry, myself, and some others from the community, we meet with the government, in particular an agency called ATSDR, which stands for the Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Prevention. They're part of the CDC in Atlanta, and their job is to study health effects for toxic exposures at Superfund sites such as Camp Lejeune. And by the way, Camp Lejeune was formally recognized as a national priority list, or what's called a Superfund site, in October of 1989. So, I mean, that's kind of the, a lot of the Camp Lejeune story in a nutshell, but as you know, there's always things that are evolving and new developments.
So, Mike, let me ask you a question. We know the range is from 1953 to 1987. What did the military know about the contamination, and really, when did they know it?
Well, and that's kind of a past that's been a question of hot debate, because depending when you ask the Department of the Navy, you know, when you ask the Department of the Navy that question, you got different answers. At first, the Department of the Navy blew things over. They allowed an error in the reporting by the media to pin things on an off-base dry cleaner, which still persists to this day. A lot of people believe that the poisoning was a result of dumping by a dry cleaner called APA dry cleaners. That's partially true. They did affect some of the wells at Camp Lejeune, but the worst and the more expensive part of the contamination was actually occurred on base in an area called Main Site. And if you understand, Camp Lejeune is not just a small little base. It's 230 square miles, and there's different parts of the base. Main Site is the main area of the base where the administrative offices are located, the base hospital, the base PX, several family housing areas. It's where the majority of the base activities occur. So, you know, the Marine Corps, over time, Jerry and I dug into the documents along with other people and started finding things. The story evolved. At first, we were talking about two primary chemicals. One was called tetrachloroethylene, and the other is trichloroethylene. Tetrachloroethylene and trichloroethylene are both organic solvents used to clean, strip away organics from materials like PCE, which is otherwise known as tetrachloroethylene, is widely used in dry cleaning. So when you take your clothes in, they spray it with tetrachloroethylene, and it strips away the grease and oils and dirt from your clothes to make them bright, shiny, sparkly, white, and clean. Trichloroethylene, known as TCE, was a chemical that was used by the military, not just the Marine Corps, but Navy, Air Force, Army, as a degreaser to help clean equipment, mainly in like the vehicle shops or maintenance shops. They would use trichloroethylene to cut through the grease on parts so they could strip it down, perform a repair, and return it back to
Why do you suppose the contamination was allowed to go on for so long? In this case, decades.
Well, mainly because the Marine Corps and the Navy, because you know there were Navy officials involved as well, weren't following their own potable water regulations dating back to 1962. But the major discoveries of the contamination started in 1980. There were no specific regulations for trichloroethylene, tetrachloroethylene, and benzene in the water. But there were naval regulations that forbade deleterious chemicals from reaching the consumer. That's quoting some of the naval documents that we reviewed over the time. And essentially what happened is in 1980, they were physically warned by outside entities, mainly an army lab and a civilian lab, that there was problems with the water. For whatever reason, those warnings were ignored. They were repeated again in 1982 by another lab. And then finally, in 1984, there was another entity that was involved, an environmental engineering group, that saw the water, the contamination in the water again. And it wasn't until late 1984, early 1985, that they started shutting the water wells at the base to protect the water and the consumers, who, and mainly the Marines and their families who were exposed at the base. And a lot of that centers on regulation. And when things, mainly changes in SARA and also the impending regulations for specifically trichloroethylene and tetrachloroethylene. Even then, with these new regulations changed, the contamination continued sporadically until 1987, when wells which and well fields that were being exposed to these chemicals finally closed.
I see. Now, Mike, you had mentioned some legislation, the Janie Ensminger Act 2012, then later some regulations that the VA passed, the Janie Ensminger Act dealing with health care, and then the VA regulation dealing with disability compensation. Could you briefly summarize for the benefit of our listeners what those benefits are? And then I have a follow-up question from a listener who sent in an email a little earlier about some things related to that.
Well, the main thing in 2017, and I'm not sure if this part was cut off, but in 2017, the VA expanded and named 8 presumptive service connections for Camp Lejeune, very similar to what everyone's familiar with Agent Orange. In this case, with Camp Lejeune, they had the service member had to be on the base within for 30 days or more, and the conditions that were created were adult leukemia, aplastic anemia, another myeloplastic syndrome, bladder cancer, kidney cancer, liver cancer, multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Parkinson's disease. These conditions were established to be related to the exposures for the known chemicals. And one thing I do want to say real quick, there's a lot of talk I see on the internet about 90 plus chemicals that we were exposed to at Camp Lejeune. Camp Lejeune is a big base, and there are dump sites throughout the base. And just because a chemical exists at a dump site does not mean that there's a toxic pathway, a toxic exposure pathway to the individuals on the base. The chemicals that we deal with and that we know had established toxic pathways, mainly through the drinking water, are tetrachloroethylene, trichloroethylene, benzene, and vinyl chloride. Those are the 4 biggies, and they're bad enough. 3 of them are known human carcinogens. Other chemicals may have been people like in the shops doing work and things like that may have been exposed to other contaminants, but those are the 4 ones that we know were established. Now, there is another pathway that, and this is part of the meeting that took place in May, called vapor intrusion, which is upcoming. We don't have the studies completed yet. We're trying to get them reviewed, to where the buildings that were over the top of the plumes, some of these buildings were exposed to vapor intrusion with the gas from the chemicals percolated up to the building and exposed the workers there. Because we see health effects extending beyond the 1987 period. We've had people in the 1990s coming down with leukemia, multiple myeloma, and that, we believe that's the result of exposure to like building 1100. The Fleet Data Processing Center, or I think it's 1100, 1101. I don't remember the exact number, but it's a Fleet Data Processing Center in the 90s. And they actually ended up closing that building down because of fuel that was leaking up from the fuel plume underneath it.
Wow. I got a follow-up question. I just want to, before I ask this, I want to make sure Rick is with us. Rick, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear
me? Okay, let me ask. Let me ask this question.
Yeah, then I got another question after you, David.
Okay, this is Mike. This question is from Amy, who emailed this question in. Can you address in utero situations from Camp Lejeune exposure? For instance, some diseases are latent and won't appear for decades. Parkinson's is an example. If a child were in utero and the service member has a presumed illness, meaning on the presumptive list that you mentioned, and then her child later grows up to be an adult and succumbs to the same illness, such as Parkinson's, will the adult child be eligible for any VA benefits, whether health care or otherwise, as long as they can provide documentation about the illness? And are there any limitations as far as time?
Okay. Now, that to qualify that question, when you say in utero, like, for example, I was born at Camp Lejeune. So I was conceived and carried and then born and spent the first six months of my life on the base. Now, because of that, I am in the 2012 Jenny Ensminger Act criteria. There are 15 named health conditions for that. Named in that bill, breast cancer is one of them. So is Parkinson's. And if I, as a dependent, come down with one of those 15 diseases, I'm entitled medical care through the VA. Now, this is where things get a little convoluted, and I'm not sure her situation. But if a child is, say, born to a veteran 3 years after they're at Camp Lejeune, then there is no entitlement to anything as far as conditions, even if they have Parkinson's, because there's got to be a criteria of 30 days or more on the base and exposed. We suspect that there's second generation effects, but we don't have the science yet to discuss that or argue it with Congress. Now, there is a big difference between the dependents and the veterans themselves when it comes to the VA. Veterans, when you're presumptive service connection, you're entitled to the VA benefits. You get medical care, death benefits, surviving spouse benefits. If you pass from a condition, then your spouse, surviving spouse, would have to get the VA. I mean, that's more of what you guys know. But there's also disability if you're unable to work or become disabled because of your condition. Now, the families, and I'll use an example here, say my father comes down with kidney cancer. As a Camp Lejeune veteran, he meets the criteria. He would receive free VA care. He would receive medical disability if he's unable to work. He passes away, my mom would get DIC. Now, me or my mother, as dependents, if we were to come down with kidney cancer, which is a condition listed in the 2012 law, we're not service members. We're not entitled to VA benefits or VA, death benefits or VA disabilities. All we would receive is, basically health care as a last resort, meaning if I have health insurance, they pay for it and then the VA would pick up the tab for anything left over. It is a disparity that we've tried to address. Fortunately, the VA is not set up to take care of families in that way. And our recourse is, through Congress and through the court system. In 2015, the Supreme Court shut the door on our to the families as far as a recourse to the Supreme Court, because the government was able to side with a private polluter in North Carolina and establish a precedent that Secretary Spencer used last year to dismiss all the family Camp Lejeune claims. We are currently trying to introduce legislation through the Bell Legal Group into Congress to see if we can get the family civil rights restored. But right now, if you're a family member, your civil rights have been effectively capped by the Supreme Court and the Department of Justice.
I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the answer, Rick.
Mike, is there any new developments on the subject matter expert?
Well, last year, the VA, I mean, we put a lot of pressure on the VA about the subject matter expert. They were hiring internal employees and training them internally. Some of these employees were of dubious background. We had one that was I'm sorry, actually, he turned out to be the head of the program for a while, but he was had his medical license stripped for alcohol abuse and molesting his own children. And this was the gentleman who was in charge of the subject matter experts. And then we found that others were overriding medical opinions from board-certified physicians, quoting Wikipedia, and also had conflict of interest, meaning one of them we learned was actually representing industry for toxic tort claims for chemical exposures, and then was turning around and providing an expert review or opinion to veterans on whether or not they were harmed by their exposures at Camp Lejeune. Now, the subject matter expert that you asked about, and this is for cases that are not of the eight presumptive category. Like, for example, male breast cancer is not a presumptive. And the VA, what they do is they hire a medical doctor and give them a paper stack of all your medical records and tell them to review it and write an opinion or a report on whether your exposure at Camp Lejeune is the cause of your disease. The veteran is not afforded any type of expert on their behalf. So it's kind of the odds are stacked against the veterans. The newest development in this issue is when we pressed the VA and Congress about the internal subject matter experts working within the VA, they since have started to and have implemented the use of independent contractors. So they're going out to other companies and hiring a company who then in turn provides the SME. And one of the first SMEs that we found for working as an independent contractor turned out to be a convicted felon who she had was arrested in Florida for tax evasion and then was actually out on probation for the federal government and reviewing veterans' claims, which is crazy. It's ludicrous.
Yeah, I just had a BVA hearing and we got into the subject matter expert in that report in that case. And I was just wondering if there's anything new on your front, because I know you've been fighting that. And that's a big deal. That's a huge deal.
Now, the thing that we're fighting that's kind of new, you know, as veterans go out and treat for their conditions, like, for example, I had a veteran contact me a couple weeks ago. He successfully treated for bladder cancer. And while you're treating for cancer, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you guys are more of the specialists than I am on this, while you're actively treating for cancer, your disability is 100%. Once the treatment is complete, then they go back and revisit and re-rate you. And what we're finding is that the VA will drop, you know, you treat for VA, for bladder cancer, and they drop you down to 0% once they say you're cured. And they disregard the fact a lot of times, like, and this is something that we've seen over and over again. They'll disregard, treatment by chemotherapy, which is, you know, damaging to your body and leaves long lasting effects. Disregards surgical scars, disregards the, like a bladder amputation and, you know, and things like this, which is improper in my opinion. And so what ends up happening is the veteran gets treated, and then they say you're magically cured, no side effects, you're 0%, move on, which is, you know, a lot of guys don't understand that there's residuals that need to be addressed and that these ratings should not be dropped to zero automatically. They need to be reviewed.
Correct. Yeah, I see that quite a bit with the cancers that start out at 100%, and then you get the letter saying that they propose within 60 days to reduce, and the VA then goes in and reduces it, maybe not even to zero, maybe to 20 or 40, but they probably could even be entitled to 60, and it's all based on the residuals, you know, how many times you urinate during the day, how often at night, do you wear a diaper, I mean, those kind of things, how often you change your diaper. And the VA tends to just kind of gloss over those residual effects when it comes to these cancers. So, yeah, if any veterans are listening out there and you're in this situation, you definitely have to appeal. If they reduce you from 100 down to 0 or 20 or 40, make sure your representative takes a look at that, because you can possibly get an increase even to higher, up to 60. I think it's almost the max you can get based upon the residuals. You know, everyone talks, Mike, everyone talks about Camp Lejeune, and I know Camp, I like to say Camp Lejeune is kind of like the poster child for this water contamination. But you know, how widespread is the problem at other military installations?
Well, I mean, the Department of Defense is the single largest contaminator, environmental contaminator, across the country by far. There's a last I heard, and in, you know, I don't keep up with the numbers, but there are 132 major military installations across the country that are listed as Superfund sites. And there's no private polluter that has more than that.
Can I give an example just real quick of...
Go ahead, David.
When I was in the Air Force station in England, this is in the late 80s, and the base was owned by the British government, and we, the U.S. Air Force, basically a tenant there, but the British were responsible for maintaining the base and everything. But they had a water tower that provided our drinking water. And one day, as part of their maintenance, the British agency there, they literally painted the water tower inside and out. So you can imagine the shock when people were turning on their spigots in their base housing, and the water, although it appeared to be somewhat clear, smelled like paint fumes. It was just incredible. And you could think to yourself, how can this stuff like Camp Lejeune happen? It's just a reminder. Sometimes this stuff is just blatantly obvious. There's just a lack of common sense. In any event, when I was stationed later,
common sense, but I would say more of a lack of just following regulations. By the way, when you mentioned paint, one of the stabilizers in paint is trichloroethylene. They use it to keep paint fluid, and as the TC evaporates, it hardens the paint. So when you paint the inside of a tower, well, you just put TC in your cap on it.
Sure. Oh yeah.
And, you know, a lot of, and when you say that, David, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's a big point because that's something the Marine Corps and the Navy have been saying all along. Well, you know, we're not doing anything different than anyone else. You know, it was a huge accident. And when the onus came on them, you know, there's no specific regulations for the chemicals. And they completely disregard the fact that, you know, in the instance of the Navy wrote their own potable water regulations under BUMET starting in with the Bureau of the Navy back in the turn of the century and stuff. So one of the regulations that we saw was a 1962, what they call NAVMED P50-10 instruction set, which was the Navy's internal potable water regulations that superseded anything that the government had or did not have. And these regulations were light years ahead of the time, and if they've been followed properly, a lot of the contamination exposures at Camp Lejeune would have ended by 1962, but they weren't. And you have expediency where people cut corners to save money, save time, or don't want to deal with red tape. And unfortunately, when you do that, you have unintended consequences, like having your water taste like paint fumes.
Right. Mike, I know your organization has done a lot. You mentioned the legislation, the regulations. At this point in time, what would you like to see Congress do, for instance, on your wish list of sort of corrective measures?
Well, the first and foremost is we need a health registry for the Camp Lejeune personnel. Pretty much every major toxic exposure, including Vietnam, now the Gulf War veterans, they have a registry where veterans can go and self-report these report their illness. Now, the catch is, yes, they're self-reported, but you need to verify with diagnosis and documentation to ensure the integrity of the registry. And one of the important things for the registry is twofold. One, it's a gateway for further studies. Male breast cancer is rare. And when I got involved at Camp Lejeune, no one was looking at it, and we weren't really paying attention to it. Well, once I started talking about it, all of a sudden, men started popping out of the woodwork saying, oh, I have breast cancer and I was at Camp Lejeune. And now we have over 115 men who have the single commonality of exposure at Camp Lejeune and male breast cancer, which is the largest that I'm aware of male breast cancer cluster in the world. So
you know, research is the big part for registry. The second part is, you know, when you have these conditions showing up, like male breast cancer or aplastic anemia, when you have them on the registry, it also gives policymakers like Congress and policymakers in the VA a tool to look at and recognize that, hey, there's something going on here, so they can address these conditions and we don't have to necessarily fight the VA for a presumptive service connection. I mean, if you've got, you know, 1,000 men with breast cancer and they're all tied to Camp Lejeune during this time period, well, you know, instead of having to fight tooth and nail for presumptive service connection, it can support an argument to add that in. So that's the first thing that I would like to see the Congress do. The other, which is what we're currently working on now, is, you know, we want to see the civilian rights restored. And that is, like I said, the Bell Legal Group is actually actively getting co-sponsors, and I believe we have 27 co-sponsors for the legislation on that. And that is basically to allow the tort cases for the families to move forward, even though there's a Supreme Court precedent to block the cases. And then the other part is, you know, we need to get these conditions looked at periodically. You know, we've got 8 on here, but we have other conditions that we see a lot of at Camp Lejeune. There are some that are established by science, like scleroderma, that are not on the presumptive service connection. We need a way to the VA to actively, instead of being reactive, but proactively work with science and the community to get other conditions that are related to Camp Lejeune added to the list.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Mike, the Janie Ensminger Act, which covers health care reimbursement, has 15 diseases, illnesses, cancers on the list, and yet the regulations, which came out, you know, 5 so years later, only has 8, and one of the ones that was left off was breast cancer.
Yes.
And that's not the only one, obviously. The list went from 15 to 8. Any thoughts
actually,
on that?
When the VA, it was Shinsky, went to move to do the announcement for the presumptive service connection, it was only 3, in which there was a lot of politicking that went on behind the scenes, and we don't have time to go into all the details on that. But the VA was pressured, and we called them out on through Congress, because Congress was, you know, through the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, was putting a lot of pressure on the VA, mainly because the contradictions of the subject matter experts, like I said, the Wikipedia argument that was used to deny a claim, and the science was there to show that these conditions were attributed to Camp Lejeune. There's science to establish that male breast cancer was attributed to Camp Lejeune. But the VA, for whatever reason at the time, tried to just do leukemia and leukemia-connected diseases, which would be a multiple myeloma, leukemia, and aplastic anemia. Those conditions, were broadened. When the final version came out, they had left bladder cancer off the list, and we had to fight to get that established. The whole process of the VA trying to determine what the conditions are was unilateral, mainly on the part of the VA. And it took a lot of fighting to get them to recognize or at least talk to other agencies, including ATSDR. So, and I forgot the other part of your question. I kind of went off tangent a little bit. I apologize.
No, that was good, because I basically was just asking you, if you had a wish list, or I know you have a wish list, what would you like Congress to do at this point? And you mentioned, among other things, you know, the Congress act on the list, and also to review it periodically, as you said, because more evidence comes to light. And it is fascinating. It's disappointing that the Veterans Affairs Committee and Congress itself didn't essentially just follow what they did with the Janie Ensminger Act and make it a statute, you know what I mean, as opposed to punting it over to the VA and let the VA's regulatory system kick it around for 5 or 6 years and still end up with the shorter list. Now,
Male breast cancer, for example, and this is kind of an important point, male breast cancer is a rare disease. There's not a lot of studies on it because there are not a lot of men that get breast cancer, and you need people to do studies. So the science isn't all there. There have been studies that have been done, and some recent ones that were done in China that are showing a link to it, but they're not conclusive studies because there's not a body of scientific evidence to point in one direction. So the VA's response to the conditions like that is, well, there's no evidence and they just deny it. So when you get these rare cancers or oddball cancers like glioblastoma, they don't necessarily act quickly on it, and it's more of a fight to get that even considered.
Right. Mike, how can listeners help your organization?
Well, if you're a veteran to Camp Lejeune and you've been affected and don't have a VA claim in, even, you know, I've heard this from Vietnam vets. They think, oh, I'm 100% service-connected from Agent Orange. Well, bladder cancer is not a service-connected disease for Agent Orange. It's either bladder cancer or kidney cancer. Forgive me, I don't remember which one. But if you should develop that and then die, well, your Agent Orange service connection doesn't do you any good for your surviving spouse or your death benefits and things like that, because, or even if you get sick, because, you know, it's not listed as a service connection. So if you have a condition, go to the VA, and, you know, a condition that is attributed to Camp Lejeune, especially the presumptives, go to the VA and file a claim. And get your, you know, get your service connection, because I've seen that happen where, you know, people do develop these things as they get older. And that's one of the things on the studies that we've noticed is that the Camp Lejeune cohort of, people that were exposed are relatively young. They're in their 50s, they're in their 60s, and even the scientists saying that, hey, as these, they want to go back and revisit because as these veterans become older, then the likelihood of something going wrong or these toxic diseases popping up later in life are more likely. You know, your question earlier about from Amy,
yes.
You know, the latent effect of the disease, you may be exposed and then 20, 30, 40 years later, boom, you've got cancer.
Yep. Let me ask you this, Mike. Now, one of the wish list things you had for Congress would be to create a registry so people can register, and that can be the source of further study. But in the absence of such a registry, would your organization, the Few, the Proud, the Forgotten, are you acting as sort of a central gathering point of information that you mentioned that one thing veterans ought to do is file claims, but can they relay their experience to your organization, and so that your organization can essentially compile more information in your efforts to try to influence legislation?
Yeah, we've done that in the past, and that's how we got some of this legislation passed in the first place. Because what would happen is a veteran would go file a claim for male breast cancer, and then they would be denied. And then what would happen is once we get the denials, then we can look at them and see what they're arguing, because we would know, you know, we knew some of the science behind it, and then we started seeing patterns. And that developed over time. So we don't, you know, when you mentioned the Few, the Proud, the Forgotten, I mean, it's a volunteer organization. We don't collect money. We don't, you know, solicit funds, and we're not organized like the Vietnam Veterans Association that has a core organization and professionals working for them. You know, it's Jerry, myself, and other Marines, in some cases, Navy personnel that has stepped up to ask to help out, and we just try to provide information. We're not in a capacity to give legal advice. We refer people, you know, to a lawyer when it gets to those, you know, those type of questions as far as what to do. But when it comes to policy, when we can get a stack of veterans that come up and say, hey, I have bladder cancer and I've had chemo and part of my bladder removed, and then after I treated, they gave me 0%. And then we can say, here's example A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and show a pattern, then that gives us ammunition to go to the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee to put pressure on the VA to change what they're doing. Does that make sense?
I see. Yes, absolutely. For the benefit
and that's
of
what
our
we've done in the past.
Yeah. For the benefit of our listeners, what's your website and what social media sites do you have that they could perhaps look to for more information?
Well, the current website is the few, the proud, the forgotten. There's a lot of static information on there, timeline of events, news stories and things like that. We're kind of working to overhaul. Once again, I mentioned that we're a volunteer organization. My son is a computer guru and he's working on trying to update the site from 2009 to 2020 standards. Most of the activity that takes place now is on our Facebook page, which is called Camp Lejeune Toxic Water Survivors.
I see. Very
and
good.
You'll see there's another group out there that calls them the same name. The difference being that, we've got about 17,000 members and the cover art on the Camp Lejeune Toxic Water Survivors is a picture of a Newsweek article, of a Marine in dress blues wearing a mask, which of course that takes a different significance today with all the COVID stuff, but he's wearing a mask and kind of green looking, because of the exposure. And that was the cover for a Newsweek article back in 2015, I believe.
I see.
Very good. It's a very active site. You know, I'm probably on it every day just by checking my Facebook, and you're always seeing somebody, probably half a dozen to a dozen I see every day, you know, talking about their case, talking about their claims, what's going on. And so, that's a good one.
Like I said, there's a lot changing.
A lot of questions for you. But before you go, and it's a great story. You were invited to the White House when Obama signed the Jerry Ensminger Act. And you got a great story about how that happened and actually who opened the door for you.
Well, one of the people that helped us get into the White House was Erin Brockovich. She became active with the issue. She has a son that was in the Marine Corps. He wasn't exposed to the contamination, but she understands. And she actually got us one of the first meetings with the White House Office of Management Budget before we got the law passed and the bill passed in the law, and then the invitation to the White House. I'm not sure what you're referring to specifically.
Well, you went into the Oval Office.
Huh?
When you went into the Oval Office.
I'm just drawing a black for it.
Did you visit the White House in 2012 for the signing of the Jerry Ensminger Act?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, after the law was passed, Jerry and I were both invited to witness the signature, which, I mean, it was an incredible honor, first of all. And the producers of the documentary, by the way, if you've not seen it, there is a documentary about Camp Lejeune that details a lot of the efforts that Jerry and myself were involved in. It's called Semper Fi, Always Faithful. Well, the producer and filmographer of the documentary, Rachel and Tony, were invited along with Jerry and myself, and then the co-sponsor of the bill, Jeff Miller, he's a representative from North Carolina, and then the chairman of the then House Veterans Affairs Committee, also Chairman Miller, he was invited as well. And it was just—it was a neat experience to be in the Oval Office, and I was standing next to the Resolute desk, and sitting there thinking the Forrest Gump line to myself, and kind of chuckling as I'm looking around the White House, and thinking, oh, I gotta pay. But the big thing for me was, being a history major and a history teacher. Sitting in the Oval Office and witnessing all the things that have gone there before and then being a part of history, it was a neat honor. And of course, meeting Mr. Obama at the time was something else. One of the neat things that happened was they told us that we couldn't ask certain questions, we couldn't bring our cell phones in, and they marched us down an aisle and told in this little cramped hallway and told us to wait there. And I expected a lackey to open the door and say, you can see the president now. And instead, the door flew open and you heard, hey there. And Mr. Obama sitting there right in front of the door and greeted us each one individually and shook each of our hands as we came into the room. And
That's the story. Yeah. That's a great story.
Well, yeah. And of course, when I got to be my turn, I kind of squeaked when I said, my name is Mike Partain. Because I was a little nervous, not every day you get to be in the White House, let alone shake the hand of the President of the United States.
Well, very good. Dave, you have anything else?
No, thanks a lot for being with us, Mike, and keep up the great work.
You're most welcome.
Well, appreciate
thank
it,
you,
Mike.
Guys.
Thanks
I know you've helped some of our veterans out in the past.
Thank you.
And, you know, we need all the help that we can get. You know, the VA does have the cards kind of stacked against the veterans when it comes to arguing these conditions. And, you know, it's heartbreaking to see some of these guys that are physically broken and then be spiritually broken because their claim's been denied on some BS reason that the VA came up with.
Right. Right. Well, thanks again, Mike, for being on our show. And as always, you have an open invitation to join us whenever you want to. Keep us updated. Keep our listeners updated on developments.
We will. And thank you.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Y'all take care.
You too.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Best to Carly.
I will.
Well, thanks to our guest, Mike Partain, co-founder and public spokesman for the organization The Few, The Proud, The Forgotten. With a lot of expertise about the toxic water contamination at Camp Lejeune from 1953 to 87. All right, Rick, we've got some news, and we've got about 7 minutes left in the show. So what would you like to cover next?
Well, I just wanted to point out, you know, Mike talked about these subject matter experts, and, you know, I just had a hearing, and in the decision that the VA gave, they referenced the subject matter expert. And it virtually was probably half a paragraph of like four lines, five lines. And yet when the VA decision review officer made her conclusion, she just went right to the SME and said, based on the SME, I'm denying the claim. Yet in the decision, in the body of the decision, there was really no good explanation coming out of the SME. So it was like, reference the report, don't really disclose the report, but the report's going to be definitive and the veteran's claim is denied. And, it's going to be quite a fight. So.
Now, Rick, let me ask you.
You know, go ahead.
Let me ask you. Now, that decision, was it a one from a regional office or was it from the Board of Veterans Appeals?
That came from the regional office. So we had our hearing with the up in Louisville, which is where all the Camp Lejeune cases are venued. And you know, we had our hearing there, we testified there, my client's wife testified, and then the hearing officer said that she was going to, you know, refer it to the subject matter expert. And of course, at that point, I said to her, okay, I understand that's the process. And I asked her point blank. Now, you know, you've heard the testimony here. You've seen my medical evidence on behalf of my client. Are you going to waive the subject matter expert against the evident medical evidence that I've provided you and the factual history that we provided you? Are you going to waive that evidence? Or are you just bound to the subject matter expert? And of course she said, oh, I'm going to weigh the evidence, sir. I'm not down to the subject matter expert. Well, then you get the decision. And there was no weighing of anything.
Yeah.
And she just, you know, threw it right down on the subject matter expert and it was denied. And
I know I can't predict anything on that particular case, but just my general observation is, most veterans get a fairer evaluation of their case with more detailed explanation from the Board of Veterans Appeals. So, the lesson for our listeners is the regional office, whether it's Louisville regional office or other types of issues at other regional offices, their decision is not the end of the road. You can still appeal it. And I know you know this, Rick, and the Board of Veterans Appeals.
And on that note, the judge said something, this judge that I had on Thursday, she was terrific.
And this is a different case, though, we're talking about.
We were talking about the experts and medical experts. And I said to her, I said, Judge, you know, it's difficult sometimes to get doctors to, you know, do a disability benefit questionnaire and form an opinion on behalf of the veteran. And she agreed with me. And then she said, you know, Mr. Hurley, she said, unfortunately, so many of these doctors think that they have to be right quote unquote, that they have to be 100% correct. These doctors have to realize, and David, you know this, you know, that the standard is as likely as not. That's the bottom line standard. The benefit of the doubt rule is it as likely as not. And she said, so long as I get that from a medical practitioner, I'm going to go down the side of the veteran, and the heck with the subject matter expert report. So yes, there is hope out there. And, you know, the veterans, you just have to keep plugging away, find those doctors that will give you the kind of report that you need, because this judge,
we gotta educate the doctors.
Unlike
the
VA, this judge isn't bound by VA policy. So,
well, not bound. I would phrase it like they're not bound by the more superficial rubber stamping analysis you see at a lot of regional offices. That they just are willing to they're just willing to take the time and analyze the evidence because they're judges. They're administrative judges. But they're judges, they're lawyers, they're not the less experienced, typically non-lawyers who are making these decisions at the regional office level. So, well, we're about 2 minutes from the end of the show, Rick.
Back to what Mr. Wells said a couple of months ago when he said at that seminar you and I were at, he said, tell veterans, and this was quoting a judge, that judges are there to help the veteran. Not help the VA. We're not interested in the money. We're interested in helping the veteran. So there is hope at the Board of Veteran Appeals.
Sure. Sure. Okay. We got about 2 minutes left. One item of quick news, and then we'll go to our coaching into care program. I know we're at the end of June. June has been Post-Traumatic Stress Awareness Month for the VA, and the VA announced just this past week that in working with the Postal Service, some of you may or may not have known that since last December up through May, the Post Office was issuing a stamp, Healing PTSD, what they call a semi-postal stamp, which is basically a charity stamp to help raise money. They raised $717,000 to donate to the VA, which the VA is going to use as part of their ongoing post-traumatic stress prevention program. So that's an interesting example of Post Office actually getting involved with this. All right, Rick, over to you.
It's a good looking. I've gotten those stamps. It's a good looking stamp too.
Yeah. Okay. How's our
Coaching into care. This program helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching into care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call at It's a toll-free call at 1-888-823-7458. The hours of operation are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, Coaching in the Care's number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they do not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Over to you, David.
Well, it's time for us to go for this evening. I'd like to thank our special guest, Mike Partain. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Corey and Hurley Law Group, and thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, here on BBSRadio.com, Station 1. Till then, stay safe and stay healthy, and have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on BBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.